This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, my name is John Zinser, and this is the New York Times Hour for Friday, the 3rd of May, 2024. Our first article. Biden denounces violence on campus, breaking silence after rash of arrests. President Biden defended the right to dissent, but made clear that he believed too many of the demonstrations had gone beyond the bounds of free speech. President Biden broke days of silence on Thursday to finally speak out on the wave of protest on American college campuses against Israel's war in Gaza that have inflamed much of the country, denouncing violence and anti-Semitism, even as he defended the right to peaceful dissent. In a previously unscheduled televised statement from the White House, Mr. Biden offered a forceful condemnation of students and other protesters, who in his view have taken their grievances over the war too far. But he rejected Republican calls to deploy the National Guard to rein in the campuses. Quote, "There's the right to protest, but not the right to cause chaos," end quote, Mr. Biden said into cameras in his first personal remarks on the campus fray in 10 days. Quote, "People have the right to get an education, the right to get a degree, the right to walk across the campus safely without fear of being attacked," end quote. Anti-Semitism, he added, quote, "has no place," end quote, in America. The president's comments came as universities across the nation continued to struggle to restore order. Police officers in riot gear arrested about 200 people as they cleared a protest encampment at the University of California, Los Angeles, while other officers removed demonstrators occupying a library at Portland State University in Oregon. Activists erected 30 tents at the University of Wisconsin-Madison a day after the police removed tents and detained 34 people. The confrontations on Thursday followed a tense 24 hours during which police officers made arrests at Fordham University's Manhattan campus, the University of Texas at Dallas, Dartmouth College in New Hampshire, and Tulane University in New Orleans, among other places. As of Thursday, the campus unrest had led to nearly 2,000 arrests at dozens of academic institutions in the last 2 weeks, according to a New York Times tally. Administrators at some colleges, including Brown University in Rhode Island and Northwestern University in Illinois, opted to avoid conflict by striking deals with pro-Palestinian protesters to bring a peaceful end to their encampments, agreements that have drawn harsh criticism from some Jewish leaders. The protests have erupted in response to Israel's war in Gaza since the October 7th Hamas-led terrorist attack killed 1,200 people in Israel and resulted in more than 200 taken hostage. More than 34,000 people in Gaza have been killed since then, according to authorities there, including both Hamas combatants and civilians. The protesters have demanded that the Biden administration cut off arms to Israel and that their schools divest from companies linked to Israel. But in many cases, the demonstrations have included anti-Semitic rhetoric and harassment targeting Jewish students. Some of those sympathetic to the protesters pushed back against administrators for the resulting to police action. The Columbia University chapter of the American Association of University Professors on Thursday called the condemnation of Nimat Shafik, the university's president, after a police operation that removed students occupying Hamilton Hall and resulted in more than 100 arrests. Quote, "Armed counterterrorism police on campus, student arrests, and harsh discipline were not the only path through this crisis," end quote, the group said. The images of arrests and clashes have come to dominate the political debate in Washington in recent days, as Republicans seek to position themselves as defenders of Jewish students and portray Democrats and university leaders as soft on anti-Semitism. A day after the House passed a bipartisan measure seeking to codify a broader definition of anti-Semitism into federal education policy, with 70 Democrats and 21 Republicans voting no, a group of 20 Senate Republicans introduced their own version of the resolution. Quote, "Anti-Semitism is rearing its ugly head at the college campuses across our nation," end quote, said the bill's sponsor, Senator Tim Scott, Republican of South Carolina, and a possible vice presidential running mate for former President Donald J. Trump. Quote, "Jewish students are being targeted with violence and harassment, and the university presidents and administrators who should be defending them are caving to the radical mob and allowing chaos to spread," end quote. Mr. Trump weighed in on social media. Quote, "This is a radical left revolution taking place in our country," end quote, he wrote in all capital letters, as the confrontation at UCLA escalated. Quote, "Where is crooked Joe Biden? Where is Governor Newsom? The danger to our country is from the left, not from the right," end quote. Governor Gavin Newsom of California, a Democrat, issued his own statement on Wednesday. Quote, "The right to free speech does not extend to inciting violence, vandalism, or lawlessness on campus," end quote, he said. That was the formulation that Mr. Biden advanced during his televised comments on Thursday morning before leaving the White House for a day-long trip to North Carolina, where he met with relatives of four law enforcement officers killed in Charlotte on Monday, and later gave a speech in Wilmington announcing plans to replace lead pipes. Quote, "Destroying property is not a peaceful protest. It's against the law," end quote, the president said. Quote, "Vandalism, trespassing, breaking windows, shutting down campuses, forcing the cancellation of classes and graduations, none of this is a peaceful protest. Threatening people, intimidating people, instilling fear in people is not peaceful protest. It's against the law. Dissent is essential to democracy, but dissent must never lead to disorder or to denying the rights of others so students can finish the semester and their college education," end quote. Mr. Biden has been pushing for an agreement between Israel and Hamas that would end the combat, at least temporarily, but a deal has remained elusive. Under a U.S.-sponsored proposal on the table, Israel would enter a ceasefire for 6 weeks and release hundreds of Palestinians held in its prisons, while Hamas would free 33 of the more than 100 hostages it is still holding. The president and his team hope that such a first stage would lead to a longer cessation of hostilities and the release of more hostages, as well as more food, medicine, and other aid to ease the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. But American officials said that while Israel has agreed to the plan, Hamas has so far refused. The president's four-minute statement came after some Democrats, frustrated by his reluctance to speak out, pressed him to publicly address the campus uprisings. Until Thursday, Mr. Biden had offered only a couple of sentences in response to reporter questions on April 22nd that even Democrats considered too equivocal, and otherwise left it to his spokespeople to express his views. Republicans have castigated him for not weighing in himself. Mr. Biden implied that his critics were simply being opportunistic. Quote, "In moments like this, there are always those who rush in to score political points," end quote, he said. Quote, "But this isn't a moment for politics. It's a moment for clarity. So let me be clear. Peaceful protest in America. Violent protest is not protected. peaceful protest is. In calming someone in his party, though, Mr. Biden took heat from others on the political left. In their view, he employed none of the nuance that he expressed in 2020, when otherwise peaceful protests after the policed killing of George Floyd got out of control, and Mr. Biden acknowledged root causes of the anger, even while condemning violence. Quote, "He could have made some effort to do the same today," end quote, said Matt Duss, a former foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders, the Democratic Socialist from Vermont. Quote, "Instead, he chose to amplify a right-wing caricature. Unfortunately, it's consistent with an overall policy approach that shows little regard for Palestinian perspectives or Palestinian lives," end quote. In his statement, Mr. Biden emphasized that he would always defend free speech, even for those protesting his own support for Israel's war. But he made clear that he thought too many people, too many of the demonstrations, had gone beyond the bounds of simple speech. Quote, "Let's be clear about this as well," end quote, he added. Quote, "There should be no place on any campus, no place in America, for anti-Semitism or threats of violence against Jewish students. There is no place for hate speech or violence of any kind, whether it's anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, or discrimination against Arab Americans or Palestinian Americans." End quote. In response to questions by reporters, Mr. Biden said he would not change his Middle East policy as a result of the protest. Asked as he left the room if the National Guard should intervene, he said simply, no. The second article today, U.S. and Israel struggle with clashing visions on ending Gaza war. The Biden administration wants to focus on a ceasefire and rebuilding Gaza, but Israel's leader is pushing a new offensive. This article is by Edward Wong and Isabella Kirshner. Nearing the end of a whirlwind Middle East trip this week, Secretary of State Antony J. Blinken finished meetings with the Israeli president and relatives of American hostages held by Hamas, left his beachside hotel in Tel Aviv, and shook hands with protesters gathered outside. He looked them in the eye and said there was a new hostages for ceasefire deal on the table that Hamas should take. Quote, "Bringing your loved ones home is at the heart of everything we're trying to do, and we will not rest until everyone, man, woman, soldier, civilian, young, old, is back home," end quote, he said. The public show of empathy with frustrated protesters is something that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has avoided since the war began in October. And lately, he has focused his recent public comments on an imminent ground offensive, an invasion of the city of Rafah in southern Gaza, quote, "with or without," end quote, a ceasefire deal, as the Israeli leader put it on Tuesday. Though it was not the first time Mr. Netanyahu has promised to invade the last Hamas stronghold in Gaza, U.S. officials were taken aback by the timing of the comment. Threatening an offensive in Rafah can put pressure on Hamas to take the deal, but only if Hamas leaders think freeing hostages for Palestinian prisoners and a 6-week pause in fighting could eventually lead to a permanent ceasefire and avert a bloody battle in Rafah, where more than 1 million displaced Gazans have sought shelter, the officials say. Nearly 7 months into the war, the stated aims and diplomatic efforts of the United States and Israel seem further apart than ever, a gap that continues to widen under the domestic political imperatives of President Biden and Mr. Netanyahu. Mr. Biden and his top aides envision a path that involves Hamas freeing about 36 hostages within weeks, the two sides enacting a temporary ceasefire that leads to a permanent one, and more hostage releases. And prominent Arab nations, including Saudi Arabia, agreeing to take part in reconstruction and security efforts, as well as in normalizing diplomatic relations with Israel. Israeli officials have shown some flexibility recently on the terms of the ceasefire deal, saying they would reduce the number of hostages Hamas would have to release in the initial round to 33 from 40. Yet even as Israel yielded on these points, Mr. Netanyahu has rejected the idea of a permanent ceasefire and doubled down on his public vow to eradicate Hamas and many fighters that he says remain in Rafah, despite a widespread belief among U.S. officials that his goal is unobtainable. U.S. officials oppose invading Rafah and say Israel should carry out precise operations against Hamas leaders, not a major assault. When Mr. Blinken met with Mr. Netanyahu in Jerusalem on Wednesday, he reiterated the, quote, clear position, end quote, of the United States on Rafah, said Matthew Miller, a State Department spokesman. The pressure on the Biden administration was also clear. Mr. Biden's liberal voting coalition could fracture as opposition builds to his unwavering support of Israel in the war, jeopardizing his chances of defeating Donald J. Trump, the Republican contender, in November. The students protesting Mr. Biden's policy on American college campuses and resultant police crackdowns have further thrust the issue into the spotlight. And the United States finds itself deflecting criticism from Arab partners and governments across Asia, Africa, and Latin America, and shielding Israel from pro-Palestinian resolutions in the United Nations. Amid cries of hypocrisy against Washington, it is clear that Mr. Biden's backing of Israel will make it harder for him to win support for American policies aimed at countering Russia and China, particularly in the nations of the global South. Mr. Blinken is grappling with the challenges. On Monday, the first day of his current Middle Eastern tour, in meetings with Arab and European officials in the Saudi capital, Riyadh, he steered discussions toward a hostage release and plans for post-war reconstruction in Gaza. He made humanitarian aid the theme of his stop in Jordan the next day. When reporters asked him about Mr. Netanyahu's insistence on a Rafah offensive, Mr. Blinken said the ceasefire deal and humanitarian aid were the, quote, focus, end quote, of American efforts. The Israeli protesters outside Mr. Blinken's hotel in Tel Aviv were on the same wavelength. They have placed their hopes in the American government rather than their own to end the crisis, which began when about 1,200 Israelis were killed in the Hamas-led attacks on October 7th, and about 250 were taken hostage. More than 34,000 Palestinians have been killed in the Israeli military's retaliatory air campaign and ground evasion. Quote, SOS, USA, only you can save the day, end quote, the protesters chanted. Quote, thank you, Biden, thank you, Blinken, end quote. Mr. Biden and Mr. Netanyahu are also clashing over what Americans call a long-term political solution to the decades-old Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The Americans are working on a plan to have Saudi Arabia and perhaps other Arab nations agree to normalize relations with Israel, but only if the Israeli government commits to a concrete path with firm deadlines to the founding of a Palestinian nation. Mr. Netanyahu opposes that, as do many Israelis. Still, Mr. Biden maintains his general support for Israel in the war, and he has not placed conditions on military aid or weapons sales, something that even centrist foreign policy analysts and former officials in the United States are calling for. Mr. Netanyahu, who is clinging to power despite a slump in his international and domestic standing, faces a range of seemingly mutual exclusive choices. He is caught between the competing pressures applied by the Biden administration and the far-right members of his governing coalition, whose support is crucial for the survival of his government. His hard-right ministers are threatening to quit if the long-touted Rafah operation is suspended. Bezalel Smotrich, the ultra-nationalist finance minister, has described the hostage deal on the table as, quote, a dangerous Israeli capitulation and a terrible victory for Hamas, end quote. Itamar Ben-Gavir, the far-right national security minister, said on Tuesday that he had, quote, warned, end quote, Mr. Netanyahu of the consequences of not going into Rafah and instead agreeing to a, quote, reckless deal, end quote, ending the war. Centrists who joined Mr. Netanyahu's government in October, bringing broader political popular legitimacy to its war efforts, have given notice that they will not tolerate decisions based on political considerations rather than on national interest. The Israeli public simultaneously yearns for the return of the hostages and craves the defeat of Hamas, even as it is split over the prospects of an absolute victory. A poll commissioned this week by Kan, Israel's public broadcaster, indicated that 54% of respondents favored an initial deal that would see the most vulnerable hostages released during a 40-day ceasefire. Nearly half the respondents, 47%, said they would support a comprehensive deal for all the hostages and an end of the war. Quote, Netanyahu's political future depends on the outcome of the war, end quote, said Nachman Shai, a former government minister and an expert on Israeli diplomacy and security. Quote, he cannot juggle all the balls, end quote. For now, Mr. Netanyahu's critics say he is dithering. Some say he is relying on Hamas's leadership to reject the hostage deal on the table. Others that he is being held captive by the far-right ministers in his government. Both views could be valid. A political caricature in Wednesday's Yedat Ahronot, a popular Hebrew newspaper, showed Mr. Netanyahu sitting at his desk, marked, quote, Prime Minister of Israel, end quote, looking over the proposal for a hostage deal and declaring, quote, that will never fly with my managers, end quote. The third article today, jury hears tape of Trump and Cohen discussing hush money deal. The tape, played at the former president's criminal trial, captured Michael Cohen telling Donald Trump about a payment to a former Playboy model. This article is by Jonah E. Bromwich and Jesse McKinley. Two voices reverberated in the courtroom. The first was loud, deep, and unctuous. The second was casual, until money came up. They were discussing a deal made during the 2016 presidential campaign to silence a woman who claimed to have had an extramarital affair with the Republican candidate. The first voice on the recording belonged to Michael D. Cohen, a former personal lawyer and fixer for Donald J. Trump. The second was the candidate himself, Mr. Trump, who on Thursday sat mutely as jurors heard his words. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office used the tape, surreptitiously made by Mr. Cohen, to bring the trial's two main characters together for the first time. The recording vividly captured how Mr. Cohen reported details of a key transaction to his then-boss. On it, Mr. Cohen discusses a hush money deal that the parent company of the National Enquirer made on Mr. Trump's behalf with the former Playboy model, Karen McDougal, as well as the question of how to deal with the, quote, financing, end quote, that is the repaying, the supermarket tabloid's publisher, David Pecker. Quote, what financing, end quote, Mr. Trump asked, suddenly snapping to attention. He then directed Mr. Cohen to, quote, pay with cash, end quote. Mr. Pecker, the jurors already know, was never repaid. The existence of the recording, made by Mr. Cohen about 2 months before the election, was previously known. But it demonstrated for the jury the direct involvement of the future president in what prosecutors have said was a conspiracy to help him get elected. It capped another remarkable day in the first criminal trial of an American president. As the second week of testimony has moved along, the proceeding has doubled as an autopsy not only of the politics of 2016, but of the celebrity-obsessed digital media environment in which Mr. Trump rose to prominence. On Thursday, prosecutors concluded their questioning of Keith Davidson, a Los Angeles lawyer who had a niche practice representing people with often salacious claims against celebrities. In 2016, Mr. Davidson represented Stormy Daniels, a porn star who had threatened to go public with a damaging story about Mr. Trump shortly before that year's election. The 34 felony charges against Mr. Trump, who is facing a penalty of up to 4 years in prison, stem from that payment, which was made by Mr. Cohen. Prosecutors say the former president later sought to disguise reimbursements to his former fixer, which were made after Mr. Trump became president. On the stand, Mr. Davidson read aloud a two-word text message that he had sent in 2016. Quote, funds received, end quote. Those innocuous words marked something momentous, the first time that jurors have seen direct evidence of the hush money payment to Ms. Daniels. A defense lawyer, Emil Bove, in a furious cross-examination, painted a suddenly red-faced Mr. Davidson as a serial extortionist. He accused Mr. Davidson of shaking down the Trump campaign, as Mr. Bove said he had other celebrities, including the reality television star who calls herself Tila Tequila, and Charlie Sheen, the actor. Mr. Davidson said that during this period, he had familiarized himself with extortion law. Mr. Bove asked whether he had done so in order to better extract money from his targets while avoiding law enforcement. Quote, you did everything you could as close to the line as possible without crossing it, right? Mr. Bove said. Quote, I did everything I could to make sure that my activities were lawful, end quote, Mr. Davidson replied. Mr. Davidson began the day by describing his unpleasant relationship with Mr. Cohen and the former fixer's fevered efforts to keep allegations of extramarital affairs by Mr. Trump out of the public eye. Those efforts included discussions with Mr. Davidson about how Ms. Daniels should respond to a report about the January 2018 deal in the Wall Street Journal. Ms. Daniels said that she had no, quote, sexual and or romantic affair, end quote, with the president on, and on the stand, Mr. Davidson took pains to explain why that was, quote, technically true, end quote. He said that the one-night stand in a Lake Tahoe hotel, which Mr. Trump denies occurred, was not romantic. A prosecutor, Joshua Steinglass, asked whether Mr. Davidson intended that statement, quote, to be cleverly misleading, end quote. Quote, I don't understand the question, end quote, Mr. Davidson said, before adding he would never use the term, quote, hush money, end quote, for the money that was received. He said he preferred, quote, consideration, end quote. According to Mr. Bove, Mr. Davidson often sought to turn scandal to his and his client's financial advantage. Topics of discussion Thursday included sex tapes by figures like Tila Tequila and Hulk Hogan, the wrestler. There was talk of stints in rehab by the actress Lindsay Lohan and an attempt to shake down Mr. Sheen. Mr. Davidson repeatedly clashed with Mr. Bove, who accused him of obscuring the truth by failing to supply specifics. Quote, "I'm not here to play lawyer games with you," end quote, Mr. Bove said. "I'm just asking for truthful answers," end quote. Quote, "You're getting truthful answers, sir," Mr. Davidson shot back, putting a sarcastic spin on the final word. After Mr. Davidson left the stand, a forensic analyst who works for the district attorney's office took the stand and soon introduced the recording of Mr. Trump and Mr. Cohen kibitzing about the payment to Ms. McDougal. In another recording that was played while Mr. Davidson was on the stand, jurors heard Mr. Cohen say in 2017 that Mr. Trump hated, quote, "the fact that we did it," end quote. Mr. Davidson explained that Mr. Trump had been referring to the payment to Ms. Daniels, providing a boost to the prosecutors seeking to corroborate Trump's knowledge of and involvement in the deal. As he did when he first took the stand Tuesday, Mr. Davidson spent much of the day denigrating Mr. Cohen, describing him as aggressive, unpleasant, and occasionally unhinged. He testified about Mr. Cohen's despondency after the 2016 election, when he learned Mr. Trump was not planning to include him in the administration. Quote, "I can't believe I'm not going to Washington," end quote, Mr. Davidson recalled Mr. Cohen saying. Quote, "I thought he was going to kill himself," end quote, Mr. Davidson said. Mr. Cohen, in 2019, testified before Congress that he had not sought an administration job. That contradiction and the manifold unflattering comments about Mr. Cohen could aid the defense, but prosecutors may also be hoping that airing them will remove their sting, immunizing the jury against damaging information. They have introduced Mr. Cohen in phases, first through remarks from people who know him, then with his voice and his picture. In coming weeks, Mr. Cohen himself is expected to testify. By that time, he may be a known quantity for jurors, one of whom has said he listens to Mr. Cohen's podcast. Mr. Trump himself has continually attacked Mr. Cohen in remarks and online posts that have been discussed at two different gag order hearings, one of which resulted in a contempt of court fine of $9,000 and a warning of jail time if he persisted. On Thursday morning, the judge, Juan M. Merchan, heard arguments about four additional statements that prosecutors say violate the order, including remarks in the hallway outside the court, where Mr. Trump has taken to attacking the case and Democrats he feels are behind it. The judge did not immediately rule. Mr. Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee for president, has complained vociferously about the trial, saying it is taking him off the campaign trail and baselessly suggesting that President Biden orchestrated the prosecution. Other targets have included the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin L. Bragg, who brought the case, and Justice Merchan. Still, Mr. Trump's demeanor in Justice Merchan's courtroom has been different than in other recent trials, where he has had outbursts and even stormed out. Mr. Trump has been largely subdued, often sitting with his eyes closed as testimony unspools. At some point, he seems to have dozed off. In a post on Truth Social on Thursday afternoon, Mr. Trump denied falling asleep. Quote, "I simply close my beautiful blue eyes sometimes, listen intensely, and take it all in," end quote, he wrote. In his questioning of Mr. Davidson on Thursday, Mr. Bove, the defense lawyer, pointed out that the witness had never met or interacted with Mr. Trump. Quote, "In fact, everything you know about President Trump came from either TV or Michael Cohen?" End quote, he asked. Mr. Davidson conceded he had no personal interactions with Mr. Trump. But prosecutors argue that Mr. Davidson did not have to know Mr. Trump to understand the importance of the hush money payment in his bid for the White House. Prosecutors asked Mr. Davidson to explain a text exchange right after Election Day 2016 with Dylan Howard, a top editor at the National Enquirer, who had helped broker the deal among Mr. Cohen, Mr. Davidson, and Ms. Daniels. Quote, "What have we done?" end quote, Mr. Davidson asked the editor. The fourth article today, rare editions of Pushkin are vanishing from libraries around Europe. Dozens of books have disappeared from Warsaw to Paris. The police are looking into who is taking them and why. A tale of money, geopolitics, crafty forgers, and lackluster library security. This article is by Rachel Donadio. In April 2022, soon after Russia invaded Ukraine, two men arrived at the library of the University of Tartu, Estonia's second largest city. They told the librarians they were Ukrainians fleeing war and asked to consult 19th century first editions of works by Alexander Pushkin, Russia's national poet, and Nikolai Gogol. Speaking Russian, they said they were an uncle and nephew researching censorship in Tsarist Russia so the nephew could apply for a scholarship to the United States. Eager to help, the librarians obliged. The men spent 10 days studying the books. 4 months later, during a routine annual inventory, the library discovered that 8 books the men had consulted had disappeared, replaced with facsimiles of such high quality that only expert eyes could detect them. Quote, "It was terrible," end quote, Krista Aru, the director of the library, said. Quote, "They had a very good story," end quote. At first, it seemed like a one-off. Bad luck at a provincial library. It wasn't. Police are now investigating what they believe is a vast, coordinated series of thefts of rare 19th century Russian books, primarily first and early editions of Pushkin, from libraries across Europe. Since 2020, more than 170 books, valued at more than $2.6 million, according to Europol, have vanished from the National Library of Latvia in Riga, Vilnius University Library, the State Library of Berlin, the Bavarian State Library in Munich, the National Library of Finland in Helsinki, the National Library of France, university libraries in Paris, Lyon, and Geneva, and from the Czech Republic. The University of Warsaw Library was hardest hit, with 78 books gone. The books are worth tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars each. In most cases, the originals were replaced with high-quality copies that mimicked even their foxing, a sign of sophisticated operation. The disappearance of so many books of the same ilk from so many countries in a relatively short period is unprecedented, experts said. The thefts have left libraries to boost security and put dealers on high alert about the provenance of Russian books. How Russian rare books came to be at the center of a possible multinational criminal conspiracy is a story of money and geopolitics as much as of crafty foragers and lackluster library security. Authorities, librarians, and experts in Russian rare books believe the thieves are smaller fish operating on behalf of bigger fish. but who is behind the thefts and what motivates them remain open questions. First editions of Russian's Golden Era writers have sold for 5 and 6 figures in recent years at Western auctions. Experts say there is a thriving market for them today in Russia, where they have tremendous cultural and patriotic value. French authorities have not ruled out a state-sanctioned drive to bring Russian treasures home to Russia. According to Europol, the authorities have arrested 9 people in connection to the thefts. 4 were detained in Georgia in late April, along with more than 150 books. In November, French police placed 3 suspects in custody. Another man has been convicted in Estonia, and a 5th suspect is in jail in Lithuania. A special French police unit dedicated to fighting cultural theft is overseeing the investigation in France and coordinating across Europe. Authorities paint a picture of a network of associates, some blood relatives, traveling across Europe by bus with library cards, sometimes under assumed names, to scout rare Russian books, make high-quality copies, then swap them for the originals. Case files reviewed by the New York Times have revealed. The investigation, dubbed Operation Pushkin, was reported in depth by Le Parisien, a Paris daily. The director of France's cultural police unit, Colonel Hubert Percy Dessert, declined to comment on an ongoing investigation. In Russia, Pushkin is a national icon with the status of Shakespeare, but the familiarity of a friend. A romantic poet, novelist and playwright, aristocrat, libertine, writer on freedom and empire, he brought Russian literature, and the Russian language itself, into modernity before dying in a duel at age 37 in 1837. Quote, "In Russia, for the past 200 years, there were not 4 elements in nature, but 5, and the 5th is Pushkin," end quote. Andrei Markovich, the preeminent translator of Pushkin into French, said. Every leader of Russia has embraced Pushkin in line with his own political vision, from the czars who expanded the Russian Empire in the 19th century to Stalin, who held public celebrations across the Soviet Union on the 100th anniversary of Pushkin's death in 1937, even while purging intellectuals, to President Vladimir V. Putin, who has cited Pushkin in his speeches and unveiled monuments to him around the world. Quote, "Pushkin is the mirror of all the epochs of Russia," end quote, Markovich said. In Ukraine today, Pushkin has become a reviled symbol of Russian imperialism since the brutal Russian invasion, and people have toppled statues to him. Prices of books published during the lifetime of the Holy Trinity of Russian Romantic writers, Pushkin, Gogol, and Mikhail Lermontov, have risen dramatically in the past 20 years, in line with the rise in wealth of Russian collectors. It's a small market with relatively few books, and collectors who often have a checklist of the books they want, dealers say. Pushkin died young, and so, quote, "lifetime," end quote, Pushkins are scarce. He published, quote, "Eugene Oningi," end quote, a novel in verse, as a serial. A first edition, with some chapters in their original wrappers, sold for more than 467,000 British pounds, or 581,000 American dollars, at auction at Christie's in 2019. Western sanctions, put in place after Russia invaded Ukraine, prohibit dealers in the West from selling to residents of Russia, fueling an existing shadow market for rare books. In this market, sales are often brokered privately through middlemen with cash transactions that are difficult to trace, dealers say. Libraries are easy targets for thieves because they are intended to serve the public. They are often underfunded, without the same security as museums and other institutions with valuable works. Quote, "It's easy to get the books. It's easy to know which books you should get, and it's easy to know the value," end quote. Pierre-Yves Gilmont, a dealer in London specializing in Russian rare books, said. Gilmont and other dealers said it would be unlikely for the Russian books stolen from European libraries to turn up at official auctions in the West. The International League of Antiquarian Booksellers, a trade organization, has listed many of the recent library thefts on its missing books register. Angus O'Neill, the group's vice president and security chair, said the organization had been in regular contact with Europol to inform its members about the thefts. Quote, "Booksellers are advised to be cautious," end quote, the State Library of Berlin wrote on the missing books register, listing the five Russian books it had lost with a total value in the low six figures. Absorbing so many stolen books into the relatively small market for Russian books could be difficult. But these are the most famous books in Russia, Gilmont said, potentially attractive not only to seasoned collectors, but also to, quote, "rich people wanting trophy items." Europol said some of the stolen books had already been sold by auction houses in Moscow and St. Petersburg, quote, "effectively making them irrecoverable," end quote. The agency did not reveal which books, citing the ongoing investigation. Dealers say it is not uncommon for Russian books with library stamps to be for sale. The Soviets plundered private family collections and nationalized libraries. During the Second World War, libraries burned. The Soviets took books from Germany, and the Nazis took books from Russia. When the Soviet Union was collapsing, impoverished librarians sometimes sold library books on the sly to support themselves. In the 20th century, Russian books flowed westward as emigres sold their collections. In the 21st century, they flowed eastward as new generations of Russians brought them back. In 2018, Christie's auctioned one of the largest private collections of Russian books in the West, amassed by R. Eden Martin, a lawyer in Chicago, a sale that totaled more than $2.2 million. The recent thefts have led to heightened vigilance. Quote, "It's deeply upsetting whenever thefts like these occur," end quote. Susan Benet, the executive director of the Antiquarian Booksellers Association of America, said, quote, "Libraries are in the business of providing access to scholars and the public, and when a breach of trust like this occurs, necessary changes in security can curtail that access," end quote. The thefts seem to have caused the most public outrage in Poland, which is acutely sensitive to actual and perceived Russian aggression. Last October, the Library of Warsaw University, a former Russian imperial university with a large collection of 19th-century Russian books, discovered 78 Russian rare books missing, including first editions of Pushkin. The thefts may have begun in the fall of 2022 and continued until they were discovered 10 months later, a spokeswoman for the university said. As authorities across Europe begin to arrest suspects, so far all of them Georgian nationals, a picture is emerging of a possible network. One of the men implicated in the thefts at Vilnius University Library, which lost 17 books valued at 440,000 euros or 470,000 American dollars, is in jail in Lithuania. He is also suspected to be involved in library heists elsewhere, according to case files reviewed by The Times. In Estonia, one man was convicted on charges related to the Tartu heist. He had been extradited there from Latvia, where he served time for facilitating the theft of three books from the National Library of Latvia in Riga, one by Pushkin and two by Russian futurist poet Alexia Kirchnikonova, who is, as it happens, renounced Pushkin and sought a new poetic language. Last November, French police placed three people into custody on charges of criminal conspiracy for stealing 12 Russian books at a university library in Paris. The Paris prosecutor's office said. It said authorities had linked the alleged culprits to another theft last July at the library of a prestigious public university in Lyon. The same men had also been identified at the National Library of France in Paris, according to case files seen by the Times. These days, requesting a 19th century early edition of Pushkin in the rare books room of the National Library of France will draw nervous looks from librarians and swift requests for further information about a reader's motives. Last year, thieves lifted 8 books by Pushkin and one by Lermontov, with a total estimated value of €650,000 or $696,500, one of the largest thefts from the library in the modern era. The pattern was the same. A man showed up over a period of months to consult rare Russian books. When libraries asked the nature of his research, he claimed not to speak French or English. The librarians were doubtful, but ultimately gave him access. The man allegedly stole the books, possibly hiding them in the sling of a bandaged arm. He replaced them with such high-quality copies that librarians didn't discover the thefts for months. The library now keeps its Russian Golden Era books in its Holy of Holies, along with its rarest books, including a Gutenberg Bible. Final article for today. Judge grills U.S. and Google on antitrust claims. Judge Amit P. Mehta tried poking holes in the closing arguments of a landmark monopoly case as he weighs a ruling that could reshape tech. This article is by David McCabe and Cecilia Kang. The judge, overseeing a landmark U.S. antitrust challenge to Google, tried to poke holes in both sides' cases during closing arguments Thursday as he weighed a ruling that could reshape the technology industry. Judge Amit P. Mehta was presiding over the first day of closing arguments in the most consequential tech antitrust case since the U.S. government sued Microsoft in the late 1990s. The Justice Department has sued Google, accusing it of illegally shoring up a monopoly in online search. Google has denied the claims. On Thursday, Judge Mehta questioned the government's argument that Google's dominance had hurt the quality of the experience for searching for information online. But he also pushed Google to defend its central argument that it isn't a monopoly because consumers use other companies like Amazon to search for shopping items and TikTok to search for music clips. Quote, "Certainly, I don't think the average person would say Google and Amazon are the same thing," end quote, Judge Mehta said. His ruling, expected in the coming weeks or months, will help set a precedent for a series of government challenges to tech giants' size and power. Federal regulators have also filed antitrust lawsuits against Apple, Amazon, and Meta, and a second case against Google over online advertising. Before the start of closing arguments in a U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia courtroom, Jonathan Cantor, head of the Justice Department's Antitrust Division, approached Kent Walker, president of Global Affairs at Google, to chat. Judge Mehta began proceedings by questioning Kenneth Dintzer, the Justice Department's lead courtroom lawyer for the trial, about innovation in search. The government has argued that a lack of competition in the online search business, in which it says almost 90% of all searches are conducted with Google, means Google doesn't need to invest in the quality of its search experience. But Judge Mehta told Mr. Dintzer that it would be hard to, quote, dispute that search today looks a lot different than it did 10 or 15 years ago, end quote, and that some of that change was due to Google's work. Quote, it seems to me a hard road for you to go down for me to conclude that Google hasn't innovated enough, end quote, Judge Mehta said. The Justice Department also argued that because Google had a monopoly and didn't face strong competition, it hadn't put privacy protections into its search engine. The judge interrupted Mr. Dintzer to say there may be a, quote, trade-off, end quote, for privacy versus the quality of search. Judge Mehta added that his challenge was how to measure if Google had done enough to protect the privacy of its users. That concludes the New York Times NewsHour for today, Friday, May 3rd, 2024, from Radio Reading Services of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. My name is John Zinser. Thank you for the pleasure of your company and the honor of your time.